A Story Publishing presents Steady Hands. Prologue. From 1,000 feet up, the Commonwealth looked peaceful, as though the decade itself, newly christened the 60s, were a smooth pond waiting for only the lightest stone. Snow lacquered every rooftop from Worcester to the Cape. Street lamps burned like orderly constellations, and the navy blue hush before dawn made even Boston's restless arteries seem briefly cured of traffic. Yet the radio towers on the Prudential cracked out futures in Morse, satellites, Medicare bills, merger rumors, and a dizzy faith that efficiency could be mass-produced like breakfast cereal. Somewhere over Kansas, a jetliner stitched the continent together in 4 roaring hours. Somewhere over Cuba, reconnaissance film dried in darkrooms, and somewhere in Washington, lawyers amended a clause that would let corporations buy clinics the way railroads once bought land. America woke each morning believing it was both too large to fail and too young to die. Follow the river east until it turns reflective with moonlight, and you'll find Concord, Massachusetts, still cradling the hush that made poets mention its pond in the same breath as eternity. The town's 2 traffic lights blinked yellow through the night, warning no one. At Crawford Grocer's, a holiday display of tinned fruit cocktail shimmered behind frosted glass. At the livery, a single bulb swung above a silent gas pump, its hose stiff as a frozen serpent. Concord was the sort of place where people still called the milkman by name, where the newspaper arrived folded by hand, and where any rumor, good or ill, could hitch a ride on the church bell and be around the commons in 4 tolls. Yet even here, the century's new arithmetic had found traction. A Boston outfit called Bay Eastern Health Systems had been scouting the region, sending smooth men in smooth cars to explain, over coffee no one finished, that local medicine was out of step with modern economies of scale. The pitch traveled ahead of them like weather. Consolidate, streamline, capitalize. It sounded almost elegant unless you loved the old ways more than your balance sheet. At the north end of Elm Street, the Hollis Clinic waited in the dark like a ship at anchor. The building was nothing to brag about. 2 stories of cedar clapboard painted riverstone gray, a potbelly stove in the waiting room, and windows that rattled when freight trains moaned past Walden Pond. But the brass shingle beside the door still flashed Hollis and Son, M.D. when the mailman's torch grazed it, and in Concord that name carried 30 winters of midnight house calls, birthing mishaps, and lawn chair stitches. Folks said a Hollis could diagnose rheumatic fever by the sound of footsteps on gravel. Whether true or not, people came. The clinic's new steward, Dr. John Hollis III, had been awake since 3, lying in a boarding house room that smelled of radiator dust and chalky hotel soap. 32 and Harvard trained, he had returned from Boston General with a leather bag full of instruments and a chest full of unspoken dread. Tonight he listened to the building settle, pipe knocks, distant car chains, the metronome of his own pulse. He told himself he was merely rehearsing tomorrow's schedule, but the ceiling kept replying with the single question he refused to phrase, "Will I be enough?" Across town, Polly Finch sat cross-legged on her boarding house bed, cardigan draped over her knees, braiding her strawberry blonde hair with a pencil so she'd remember to sharpen it before clinic hours. Charts lay everywhere. Manila jackets stamped Pendergast, Sullivan, Burridge. Polly's father, Concord's retired librarian, had taught her that chaos surrendered quickest to tidy margins, so she sorted the files into chronological harmony while quoting Jane Austen under her breath. When the coal stove popped, she murmured, "Mercy me," and jotted a note, "Buy more iodine, bake apology scones for first-day patients." South of the commons, in a weather-worn farmhouse, Henry Cartwell wound his grandfather's pocket watch, listening to the click drag like an oar through water. Wind combed the orchard, rattling empty branches, but Henry's thoughts were on his sleeping wife. Ruth was in the upstairs room, silver hair fanned on a pillow, the steady rise of her chest matching the watch's slow ticks. She had promised to walk over to Elm Street on opening morning with a gift, a bouquet made of seashells wired to driftwood. Because the world, she said, never frowned at a waiting room brightened by traces of the sea. Henry kissed her forehead. tasting the faint salt left by winter humidity, and whispered, "We'll see the boy settled." Far away, in Boston's Beacon Hill, Carlton Danvers sat in Bay Eastern's paneled conference suite, feeding a roll of figures under the green visor of a desk lamp. He preferred numbers to people. Numbers behaved when pushed. The Hollis property file lay open beside him, a slim dossier paper clipped to a glossy prospectus for regional consolidation. Danvers tapped the folder once, as though waking it, and rehearsed the offer he would deliver. Malpractice coverage, modern equipment, an exit clause generous enough to feel like mercy. In his experience, everyone took the deal eventually, once the ledgers began to wheeze. By 4:30, the sky behind Concord tinted the faintest hematite, and a nor'easter stalled offshore exhaled a fleck of snow inland. The first flake landed on the clinic's shingled roof, then another, until the whole structure appeared dusted with sugar meant for some larger, indifferent confection. A bakery truck rumbled past, tires slapping potholes, its taillights painted quick red stripes across the clinic sign before vanishing down Walden Street. Inside, silence memorized the echo. At 5, John's boots hit the sidewalk. He carried two possessions, a brass key patinated by his father's thumb, and a sheaf of onion skin stationery folded twice in his breast pocket. The key opened rooms. The paper, he hoped, might unlock something tougher. Breath steamed in front of him, twisting like question marks. Snow squeaked underfoot, a sound both clean and accusing. Behind shuttered windows, he sensed Concord rousing. Somebody stabbing a waffle iron, somebody else thumbing a radio dial past static. But no one watched him cross the street, except the bronze Minuteman statue guarding the commons, rifle lifted against battles long concluded. He paused at the wooden door, heart drumming loud enough to vibrate the glass. The brass plate reflected his face, dark hair refusing perfect order, eyes bruised by study lamp glare, cheeks freshly shaved but already shadowing. Somewhere, years back, his father had barked, "Patience trusts certainty, not hesitation." The memory pricked, then steadied him. Wind nipped his collar. He slid the key into the lock. One decisive half-turn, the bolt thunked, and the door surrendered a crack, releasing a faint draft scented of phenol and old pine boards. He hesitated on the threshold, aware that crossing it would reorder every hour to come, an irreversible arithmetic of charts, pulses, and chemistries. Snowflakes pirouetted between the lamplight and his coat sleeve, melting before they settled, the briefest audition for permanence. Up on Church Street, Polly pulled her mittens tight, files under one arm, the other hand balancing a tin of cranberry scones that clinked with every stride. Her breath formed jaunty spirals, and in the soft dark she rehearsed a greeting. "Good morning, doctor." Light enough to sound like sunrise, firm enough to be taken seriously. She quickened her pace when she saw the clinic porch lamp flick on. 2 miles out, Henry steered the pickup into first gear, Ruth beside him, seashell bouquet cradled on her lap. The engine coughed, settled, and carried them toward town. Ruth hummed a line from the holly and the ivy, synchronizing with the dashboard rattle. Henry reached across, squeezed her knee, and the watch in his vest ticked faster, as if eager to meet whatever pulse awaited. And in Boston, Carlton Danvers folded the Hollis file, straightened his tie, and phoned the driver. "Concord by noon," he said. Snow, he knew, made small towns grateful for offers of shelter. On Elm Street, the door opened wider, spilling a stripe of yellow across the virgin snow. John stepped inside, coat still on, key warm in his palm now. Behind him, the wind swept the step clean, erasing his footprints until only the light testified he had passed that way. He closed the door, and the latch clicked home, muffling the world's wider roar. Somewhere in the dark interior, a furnace rumbled awake. Somewhere in John's pocket, the blank stationery waited, sharp as an unsaid vow. Outside, Concord held its breath while the first hint of dawn rolled up from the horizon, pale and deliberate, like a doctor checking a watch before giving news that will start, or change, every life in earshot. End of prologue. Night had barely released its grip on Concord. John Hollis III paused his pen over the onion skin stationery, watching a bead of ink swell at the nib as the pharmacy lamp cast a nickel-sized halo on the page. The pewter dawn gathering beyond the front windows of the Elm Street Clinic seemed to press against the glass, a slow, relentless tide. He wore his father's wool waistcoat, buttons polished to dull topaz, over a cream shirt rolled to the elbows, the fabric soft from countless washings. A loose wisp of dark hair grazed his brow, forever escaping pomade the way his thoughts escaped rest. Ink freckles stippled the side of his right hand. He had wiped the nib there countless times since medical school. Outside, the first garbage truck rattled down Walden Street, its compactor clanging like a distant bell. But inside the clinic, only the low hum of the pharmacy refrigerator and the faint scent of coal tar salve kept him company. The word father sat alone on the page, accusatory in its isolation. John rubbed the pad of his thumb over the groove where his own wedding band would have rested had he ever married, mirroring the habit his father had performed unconsciously for 30 years. Nothing followed the salutation. Nothing ever did. After a moment, he slipped the blank sheet back into the drawer with three other false starts, slid the brass knob shut, and exhaled through his teeth as though letting air out of a stubborn accordion. A memory flashed, unbidden. 14-year-old John standing in Boston City Hospital's echoing corridor, the air acrid with ether. While orderlies wheeled his grandfather, John Hollis, I, toward surgery, the old man never left. "Steady hands make steady hearts," his father had whispered, squeezing his shoulder. Now, decades later, John flexed his own fingers as if testing that maxim, wondering whether any Hollis hand could ever truly be steady enough. The memory left a faint echo, like the residual tang of antiseptic. From upstairs, the floorboards creaked, Polly Finch arriving exactly 27 minutes before opening, as she always did. She hummed a bar of "Ain't Misbehavin'," the melody floating down the stairwell until it snagged on the whistling kettle in the kitchenette. Her strawberry blonde braid was pinned up by a pencil, and her green cardigan, patched elbows and clinging cat hair from Mrs. Dowd's boarding house tabby, accented eyes the color of unripe pears. Tiny snow crystals, stowaways from outside, melted on her shoulders like secrets as she descended. "Morning, doctor," she called, voice bright with mischief that had not yet decided on its target. "In name, if not in competence," he muttered, then louder, "Morning, Polly." She appeared moments later, cheeks pink from the brisk walk from her boarding house, carrying two mugs, one chipped teal enamel, one stamped with an advertisement for bitters, and a stack of new patient forms. "Bribery," she said, handing him the teal cup. "Figured you'd need it after wrestling the ledgers last night." "Ledgers triumphed, I'm afraid." "I'll mount a counteroffensive after clinic hours." He sipped. The coffee tasted faintly of chicory and possibility. The silence that followed was companionable, the clinic seeming to breathe with them. Floor wax mixed with menthol liniment, the pot-belly stove in the waiting room pinged softly as iron expanded. Somewhere a loose roof shingle tapped a syncopated rhythm against the siding, reminding John that even buildings aged, needed tending, threatened collapse if ignored. The front door jangled open before the clock struck 7. Mrs. Pendergast waddled in, her hunting plaid coat flapping behind her like a broken sail, a shoebox clutched to her chest. She was 60-something, cheeks veined with the fine map of capillaries gardening bestows, and she smelled of mothballs and cinnamon gum. A felt hat sat crooked atop a halo of gray pin curls, as though spun there by mischievous wind. "I declare, Dr. Hollis, that confounded feline of mine has enacted Shakespearean tragedy upon my forearm," she announced, thrusting a bandaged wrist forward. "I only nudged him off the Davenport, barely a nudge, and he unsheathed like some barbarous Saracen. I bled all over Amos's apple cake. Ruined." Polly whisked her to an exam room, murmuring, "Mercy me," and something about iodine. John followed, fingers probing the patient's pulse, while Mrs. Pendergast narrated every extracurricular grievance committed by the cat, her husband, and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The scratch proved superficial. John flushed it, dabbed antibiotic ointment, and wrapped fresh gauze while Mrs. Pendergast detailed Amos's gallstones. He stitched his grin where appropriate, but inside, the old uncertainty flickered. Was he thorough enough? Did he miss a tendon, Nick? A brass pendulum clock in the hallway ticked accusatorily, each swing a reminder that a newer, shinier clinic was rumored to open on Main Street come autumn, one backed by a Boston corporation promising efficiency and modern economies of scale. When Mrs. Pendergast finally swept out smelling of camphor and indignation, Polly leaned against the doorway, arms crossed. You know, she talks so much I sometimes forget which end we're treating. She's fond of her own narrative, John said. And you're not? Polly arched an eyebrow, then softened. Stop kneading the poor bridge of your nose. You saved her cake, if not her marriage. Call that a win. The telephone rang, one sharp peal, urgent as a fire bell. John lifted the receiver. A male voice, rough and economical, said, Cartwell Place. Pete gashed his arm on the baler. It's bad, Doc, bleeding like a stuck hog. John's spine straightened. Stay calm. Keep pressure with a clean cloth. We're 15 minutes out. He cradled the receiver. Polly, pack the satchel. She was already in motion, feet quick as a typist's fingers. Suture kit, antiseptic, gauze rolls, morphine ampoules, stethoscope, extra kerosene for the lantern, and the small transistor radio that soothed jittery patients when the wind howled. She added a peppermint or two. Wounded men, she'd discovered, relaxed when their breath felt fresher than fear. John shrugged on his peacoat, checked his pocket watch, 8:10, and glanced toward the waiting room stove. Fire'll die while we're gone, Polly noted. I'll stoke it, came a mellow baritone. Henry Cartwell, coat dusted with chaff, stood in the doorway like a tree walked in from the orchard. His beard, salt overtaking pepper, clung to his jaw in winter thickness, and deep crow's feet framed eyes the color of tide pools at dusk. Ruth sent me for her iron tonic, but sounds like you need the Ford more. John pressed a grateful hand to Henry's shoulder. Keys are on the hook if you need to warm yourself. Just lock up after. Consider it done. Go tend to Pete before he paints the hayloft red. Outside, the cold tasted metallic, like holding pennies on the tongue. The sky hung low in pewter, snow whispered rumor but had not yet committed. John's secondhand Ford wagon coughed alive. Polly slid beside him, chart pad on her knees. He'll be fine, she said, patting the bag. Which one, Henry or Pete? Both, provided you keep the car on the road. Rutted lanes bucked the wagon. Maples blurred past, their spidery limbs already silvered with rime. Polly steadied the kerosene lantern between her boots, the light jumping across her freckles like goldfish in a bowl. The air was crisp with the scent of damp earth and decaying leaves. As they drove, John hummed a tune he hadn't noticed until Polly observed, "You're humming Gershwin." The melody fluttered out of him when anxiety pinched. He closed his mouth, but the doubt remained, drumming behind his ribs. A sign for Walden Pond whipped by, and John flashed to childhood summers, his father setting up impromptu clinics beneath the pines for fishing hook mishaps, young John fetching water and vowing someday to be worthy of the Hollis name. The Cartwell farm emerged from the tree line, a white clapboard house, red barn leaning as though eavesdropping on the ground. A single lamp burned in the barn loft. John braked beside the paddock, gravel sighing under the tires. Farmhand Pete sat on a milk crate, forearm wrapped in blood-soaked toweling, lantern light carved hollows in his cheeks. John knelt, and the cold seeped through his trousers. Blood oozed between Pete's calloused fingers, dark and steady. A 6-inch tear gaped from wrist to elbow, muscle tonguing open like raw steak. John irrigated the wound, crimson water pooled in a bucket, steam coiling in the lantern glow. His pulse hammered in his ears as he worked. Needle, sutures. He curved the first stitch. His hand wanted to shake. His father's voice, calm and omnipresent, whispered that one slip could mean infection, useless tendons, worse. John ground his thumb into the ridge left by the absent ring until pain focused his vision. Another stitch, cleaner. Polly stood opposite, fingers dancing out supplies before he even spoke. "Pressure's easing," she assured him between quick glances at Pete's pallor. "You're knitting him up like Aunt Ada's quilt." After finishing, John rechecked capillary refill, cleaned the surrounding skin, wrapped fresh gauze, and injected penicillin. Pete flexed the fingers experimentally. "Feels like someone's clamped it in a lobster pot, Doc, but reckon I'll live." "You'd better," Polly said. "I owe you a dance at the Grange come spring." Pete snorted, the farmhand's closest approximation of laughter. At the house, Ruth had left sandwiches covered with a dish towel and thermoses of coffee. Henry must have wired ahead on the party line. They ate standing in the kitchen, linoleum cracked like a river delta, while the mantel clock plodded toward 3 a.m. Ruth appeared in the doorway, a petite woman with silvering hair twisted into an impeccable bun and flour dusting her apron like first snow. She pressed two oatmeal cookies into John's hand. "For the road," she whispered, her smile luminous yet already edged with the fatigue none of them would understand until years later. The drive back was hushed but companionable. Polly dozed against the window, lips parted in a half smile. Concord's street lamps swam into view like lantern fish, the roads vacant save a stray newspaper cart abandoned at the curb. At the clinic, Henry's promise shone. Orange stovelight flickered behind the frosted glass. John killed the engine. "Go inside," he whispered. "I'll follow." Polly nodded, boots crunching over the new powder. Within, the door shut, and her shadow moved through the lobby, banking coals and setting tomorrow's charts on the front desk before she disappeared upstairs. John remained on the porch. Snow found his hair, melted, and started again. Shutters creaked. He could hear the building breathe, radiators ticking, the old staircase settling, a distant radio left low for company. Dawn thumbed the horizon pink, reluctant as a schoolboy rising for chapel. He slid his hands into his pockets, shoulders squared against the cold, and let the first snow of the season collect on his coat while the world turned quietly toward morning. Just before sunrise, the building exhaled its nighttime hush and invited the scent of breakfast. The breakfast bell in John's head was the faint crackle of poblano skins meeting hot cast iron. He followed the scent down the back stairs, his shoulders leaden from a night spent half-dozing against his office doorframe. The kitchen's yellow sun range pumped out enough heat to make the morning feel like June, despite the lingering snow on the windowsills. Polly stood barefoot on yesterday's newspaper, her socks draped to dry over the oven handle like surrender flags. A wooden spoon conducted bacon grease away from the peppers toward a pile of beaten eggs. Her braid had molted its pencil during the night. Red blonde strands floated around her like copper wire seeking a circuit. The morning light danced across her features, highlighting the sprinkle of freckles on her cheeks. "Morning, doctor," she said without looking up. "If you're capable of holding a cup, coffee's at your 2 o'clock. Pete sends gratitude," said the stitches itch something fierce, which you assured him means they're knitting fine. John poured himself a cup, the steam curling under his nose. "He keeping the bandage dry?" Claims he's milking with one hand and quoting the hygiene lecture with the other. Henry threatened to hogtie him if he pops a suture. Polly's eyes sparkled with amusement as she slid the skillet off the heat. John nodded, reassured, and reached for the cutting board. Pete had paid with a crate of late harvest peppers, squash the color of saffron and onions so fresh the outer skins still held soil. John brushed the clumps into the sink, the cold tap rinsing brown ribbons off the gold flesh. Water sloshed over his cuffs, ink smudged as always. And he thought, not unhappily, that honest dirt trumped red tape any morning. Polly slid the breakfast onto a plate and handed it to John. "Mind tossing that mail sack onto the table?" The postman decided snow equals chaos and left everything in one lump. While John ate, Polly sorted envelopes into small toppling piles, utility, patients, periodicals. Any letter stamped urgent skewered onto a brass nail near the phone. She sang under her breath, a fragment of My Funny Valentine, punctuating each name with a soft hum of recognition or suspicion. Halfway through a pepper-sweetened mouthful, John froze, fork hovering. Among the envelopes lay a thick one bearing the emblem of Bay Eastern Health Systems, return address Boston. That, he said, belongs in its own category. Polly eyed it. It's marked proposal. Sounds matrimonial, but the typewriter ribbon's too cold. The days turned into weeks, and the weeks into months. The clinic's fuel bill doubled, and the roof developed a leak that wept directly onto Polly's Webster's unabridged. They patched, bargained, and practiced small economies. John unrolled his sleeves only on Sundays to spare starch. Polly learned to refurbish ballpoint cartridges with eyedropper ink. Concord's lilacs bloomed, withered, and made room for Dog Day's cicadas. Patients came and went, each leaving behind a story and, if they remembered, a partial payment. One muggy August evening, John finally opened the Bay Eastern envelope. Legalese spilled across three pages, promising aggregate savings and streamlined billing. The contract suggested he relinquish patient charts to centralized code clerks, eliminating redundancy. Redundancy, John suspected, was Bay Eastern's synonym for Polly. He tucked the offer beneath his blotter and went downstairs to adjust the kerosene lamp, telling himself he'd think clearer come leaf turn. By the time leaf turn arrived, Concord was a postcard, sugar maples torching Elm Street, pumpkin displays militantly cheerful outside Crawford Grocers. Pete's scar had settled into a tidy pink rope. He flexed it like a prize while delivering a burlap sack of butternut squash. John rinsed each gourd under the courtyard spigot, small pleasures warding off the larger dread now crouched in every ledger column. One crisp Thursday, Polly called from reception, "Incoming." Her tone suggested weather, not person. John wiped his hands on a dish towel and stepped into the hallway just as a sleek Studebaker rolled to the curb. A man in a charcoal overcoat emerged, umbrella pointed groundward like a saber searching mud for enemies. His face was smooth, almost lacquered. The smile was mechanically precise. Mr. Carlton Danvers presented a card, quarter-inch thick, embossed. "Dr. Hollis, a pleasure. Bay Eastern appreciates physicians of your community engagement." The pause before engagement was microscopic but audible. Danvers's eyes scanned the waiting room, his gaze lingering on the mismatched chairs. Polly lingered nearby, pretending to inventory adhesive bandages. Beneath her calm, her mind clicked. Polly's inner voice tallied every corporate buzzword. Efficiency, optimization, vertical integration, like a poker player counting cards. In John's office, Danvers laid out the updated contract, pages fanned like a magician's deck. "We cover malpractice premiums in entirety," he said, tapping the clause. "We assume billing, you dispense care. Patients enjoy lower copays, everybody wins." John folded his hands, the first finger of his right hand tapped involuntarily. "And personalized treatment? Home calls? Legacy services," Danvers corrected. "We phase them out, liability vectors. Think of it as evolution." From the hallway came the soft racket of Ruth Cartwell's laughter. She and Henry shuffled in, Ruth's arms cradling something wrapped in day-old newsprint. Henry's barrel chest and wind-etched crow's feet were a testament to his years of hard work, and his ocean blue eyes sparkled with warmth. "Pardon us," Henry rumbled, his pocket watch chain glinting. "Brought you a taste of the coast." Ruth unfurled the parcel. A bouquet of seashells wired to driftwood, each shell swirling in natural pastel. "Picked him at Plum Island last month," she said. "Thought Polly might brighten reception with it." She set the arrangement on the desk, and Polly's eyes lit like struck phosphor. "Mercy me, that's lovelier than a window seat on the Orient." Danvers glanced at the shells as one might regard construction debris. "Charming," he said, already turning back to the contract. Ruth caught the coolness, squared her slight shoulders, and fired a broadside. Any man who can't hear the ocean in a shell needs a better ear trumpet. Henry's chuckle filled the foyer. Polly buried a grin behind the mail sack. Danvers did not flinch, but his next sentences arrived clipped, each provisional phrase razored of warmth. John leafed through the contract again. A ladybug, stowaway from the begonia on the sill, landed on the top sheet and meandered across indemnity clauses as if searching for a way out. John's gaze followed the speck of red. He imagined patients reduced to policy numbers, imagined misses. Pendergast rerouted to a call center 8 counties away, imagined Pete denied a barnside suture because it fell outside coverage radius. His throat tightened. "Mr. Danvers," he said, voice even, "I respect Bay Eastern's offer, truly, but it amputates the very limb it claims to strengthen." Danvers's expression arranged itself into disappointment, freshly starched. He slid a gold pen across the desk. "Sign today, doctor, and we fund roof repairs within the month." Outside, a gust rattled the shutters, scattering maple leaves like startled finches. John inhaled, counted silently to 4, steady hands, steady heart, and gave the pen back. "I won't be signing." Silence pooled. The ladybug lifted, drifted toward the seashell bouquet, vanished among conch spirals. Danvers rose. "Sentiment rarely survives audit, Dr. Hollis. My card, should pragmatism overtake nostalgia." He strode out, coattail slicing air. The Studebaker coughed once before fading down Elm. Polly exhaled. "Well, that was a slab of fruitcake nobody ordered." She gathered the loose pages, tapped them flush, and slid them into an envelope stamped rejected in her neat librarian's hand. John sealed it, pressing the flap like a benediction. They walked outside to the mailbox together. Afternoon sun angled low, turning every pane of clinic glass to amber. Children ambled home from school, kicking acorns, unaware of invisible wars waged for their future prescriptions. John let the envelope drop. It thunked hollow, final. He felt both lighter and abruptly older. Beside him, Polly tilted her head, listening to distant church chimes announcing 5. Her inner monologue, private as a diary margin, confessed a flicker of fear. She'd chosen this clinic like a life raft. What if the raft had just sprung a fresh leak? Yet when she looked at John studying the reddening sky, his profile etched against maple fire, she also noted a new resolve, subtle but unmistakable. "Come on, doctor," she said, giving his sleeve a tug. "Dinner won't cook itself. Henry's expecting verdict on whose chowder recipe reigns supreme." John managed a crooked grin. "Theirs uses salt pork, ours uses faith. Odds are even." They stepped back inside. Doorbells chimed their ordinary music. Behind them, leaves skittered along Elm Street, piling against curbs like unfinished letters. The narrator, future and invisible, marked that moment. Knowing 2 mostly happy years would unspool before Concord gathered again at Walden Pond, and that during those years, John Hollis III would wrestle nightly with ledgers, mortgages, and the occasional quack remedy, yet never once regret the feel of a ladybug choosing flight over fine print. The cicadas had already tuned their rattling maracas by the time John eased the station wagon onto the dusty spur road that circled Walden Pond. Late June sunlight scattered off the windshield in bright coins. Each glint forced him to squint, then relax, then squint again until the trees finally shouldered the glare aside and delivered them into a shaded parking enclave. Doors clacked, hinges sighed, and at once the low, satisfying thunk of a Coleman cooler meeting soft grass signaled that the annual clinic picnic, Polly's idea, Henry's muscle, Ruth's recipes, was officially underway. John killed the engine and listened. Beyond the hum of residual heat from the block, the shore noises sorted themselves into familiar layers. Cicadas at treetop level, dragonflies skittering like thrown pebbles over the water, children nearby shrieking each time the pond lapped above their knees. A loon cried somewhere across the mirrored surface, and the note carried an almost ecclesiastical stillness. In Concord, even birds seemed to revere the ground Thoreau once trudged. Polly bounced out first, bare-ankled, in white canvas shoes that already wore grass stains like trainee badges. She planted her fists on her hips and surveyed the clearing with the high command satisfaction of a general arriving early to claim the high ground. "Field looks even," she announced. "We can set croquet up there, food tables under the birches, and the folding chairs wherever the sun stops bullying." John retrieved the mallets from the wagon's rear compartment, the wooden heads thudding against his thigh. "We brought every wicket, right?" he asked, remembering the fiasco 2 summers prior when a missing stake had led to a heated, half-hour debate about whether the lone alder at course end could substitute. "In triplicate," Polly assured him, holding up a canvas pouch with the authority of a ringmaster brandishing a top hat. A strand of strawberry blonde hair slipped from her braid. She bit it back between her teeth, eyes sweeping the meadow for potential divots that might trip Henry's newly mended knee. They worked quickly. Henry arrived moments later, Ruth beside him, their Buick honking a gallant 2-note as it bumped over the grass. Henry's baritone laughter preceded him. He carried a galvanized tub packed with ice and soda bottles that clinked like sleigh bells. Ruth followed with a wicker basket whose lid refused to shut over layers of wax-papered sandwiches. The breeze teased loose silver threads from her bun, but when she pressed them back into place, her touch was deft and unhurried. Ruth could talk a storm still simply by refusing to hasten. Townsfolk filtered in. Mrs. Speak. Pendergast, wearing an outrageous floral muumuu that made good on its promise of shade. Pete the farmhand, arm fully healed, yet still sporting the brag scar John had knitted. Teenage Lucy Carruthers shyly balancing an upside-down pineapple cake. And George Burridge, the white-whiskered town clerk whose handshake creaked louder than his timber cane. And, inevitably, Mr. Carlton Danvers, boots polished shiny enough to render the afternoon sky. He stepped from his Studebaker, holding a straw boater, blue neckerchief framing his collar like punctuation too precise for the day. Why a corporate envoy would attend a homespun picnic was anyone's guess, public relations, reconnaissance, or perhaps simple loneliness, but he greeted each person with the same calibrated warmth, as though handing out complimentary room keys at a hotel he barely managed to tolerate. Polly spotted him and muttered, "Well, mercy me, the summer stock villain found our stage." But she tucked away the remark when Ruth approached, heroically cheerful. Ruth hugged Danvers with the same mild courtesy she saved for second cousins and well-meaning door-to-door evangelists, then ushered him toward the lemonade stand where Mrs. Pendergast officiated over a crystal pitcher the size of a baptismal font. Under Polly's brisk stage management, the croquet course blinked into existence. Arch after arch of white wire poked precisely into the humus-rich turf. Henry pounded the end stakes with a rubber mallet. Each thunk vibrated through his barrel chest, and he chuckled like an old engine catching rhythm. "All right, teams," he roared. "2 balls apiece, first side to clear the double diamond wins. No skullduggery unless it's funny." Danvers, seeing an opportunity, lifted his straw hat at a tilt that was too dashing by half. "Might I join?" "Course you might," Henry replied, handing him the yellow ball and a mallet of dubious straightness. "House rule, newcomers owe the winners root beer." The match began with a good-natured racket of smack, roll, cheer, groan. The wooden spheres clacked as they cannoned off each other. Turf divots twirled skyward like tiny airborne flags of surrender. Polly, light on her feet, sent her red ball kissing 2 wickets in 1 go and saluted the crowd as though she'd merely flicked a domino. John, mostly content to watch, nevertheless stepped in when Pete challenged him to prove those doctor hands can aim at something besides arteries. His first strike dribbled disappointingly short. The second squared Henry's blue ball clean off its path and directly toward Danvers's. Danvers stooped, determined to snatch advantage. A glint of sly bravado cut across his smile. "Watch the follow-through," Henry warned, but too late. Danvers took a swashbuckling swing. His mallet grazed the turf, caught a root, and misfired. his yellow ball ricocheted sideways, plunking his own foot, then trickled under the leg of a folding chair before sliding downhill on a secret gradient none of them had noticed. The ball bumped over a lip of earth and disappeared into the pond with a faint bloop. More dramatic was the collateral damage. Danvers's hat, knocked askew by his own mallet, sailed like an elegant frisbee and, propelled by a mischievous gust, skittered across the water. It spun there, brim upturned, a miniature lifeboat adrift. Henry slapped his thigh, a thunderous guffaw ripping free. "I warned you about skullduggery, son." Even Ruth laughed, the high, clear sound John always associated with clean sheets snapping on a line. Polly folded over herself in hilarity, braid bobbing like a metronome gone rogue. For one soaring instant, everyone was simply a neighbor, not a patient or a ledger entry or a potential litigant. Even Danvers managed a sportive half-bow, though John caught a flash of mortification behind the polished grin. Minutes later, Pete returned the errant boater by wading ankle-deep. Danvers dabbed it with a handkerchief, already calculating ways to exit the anecdote with dignity intact. The sun arced higher, heat pooling beneath the collar of John's linen shirt. Ruth laid quilts on the grass, arranging plates of deviled eggs and cucumber sandwiches like a summer constellation, Orion rendered in mayonnaise and mustard seed. Polly roamed with a coffee can collecting spare wicket stakes, then perched on a cooler to fan herself with a church program. She felt the day, as she would later tell her diary, settle sweet as a hymn's last chord. John refilled lemonade cups, humming Gershwin out of habit. Every few steps he paused to catalog the little indicators of health, Ruth's color, Henry's breathing, the steadiness of George Burrage's handshake. He never stopped being physician, but here among laughter and sun-buttered sandwiches, the duty felt more like benign guardianship than career. "Doctor?" George's voice, normally robust, sounded as though routed through burlap. John turned. The old man stood near the edge of the quilts, one hand braced on his cane, the other pressed just above his breast pocket. His skin, usually florid from decades of volunteer officiating at Little League, had drained to the color of new parchment. "Sit down, George." John's tone betrayed no alarm yet. He guided the clerk onto a lawn chair and crouched, fingers already at the man's wrist. The pulse leapt fast, erratic, as though racing itself toward a wall. "What's doing, Doc?" George wheezed. His brow shone, and a fine tremor ran across his jaw. Polly saw the tableau even before John called. Her clipboard hit the grass. She crossed the few yards at a near run, digging in her satchel for the slender cylinder of nitroglycerin tabs they kept for emergencies exactly like this. Henry barked, "Make space!" His shipbuilder's voice still carried enough command to part bystanders as easily as gulls scatter from a pier piling. Ruth knelt by George's other side, murmuring steady nonsense about Cape Ann sunsets. No one calmed a crisis like Ruth with her gentle lighthouse keeper's cadence. John loosened George's collar, slid two fingers along the carotid to compare the errant wrist reading, and asked, "Pain middle of the chest or left?" "Middle," George rasped. "Like ox yolk made of fire." Polly arrived, palm open. "Nitro." John placed the tablet beneath George's tongue. "Slow breaths, in through the nose, out the mouth." "Henry, the ranger station has a payphone. Tell them acute myocardial infarction. Male 69. Instruct Concord General to roll an ambulance code 3. Henry pressed his pocket watch once for courage, then lumbered off in a ground-eating jog that belied his thick frame. Each stride snapped dry twigs, the noise as functional as a siren to everyone on shore. John elevated George's knees with a rolled blanket, then unbuttoned the man's cuff and checked the time on his own watch. 30 seconds, pulse still skipping like a cracked record. Another tablet, sweat beaded along George's temple. And for one shattering moment, John's vision tunneled inward to the memory of standing in Boston City Hospital's corridor, watching his grandfather vanish on an ungainly gurney. Steady hands make steady hearts. He anchored himself by gripping George's forearm, The old skin felt fragile as pastry paper, yet beneath it life hammered, demanding equity. At 90 seconds, Ruth whispered, "He's breathing easier," but John saw the pallor deepen. He repositioned the man to half-sitting, keeping the airway clear, mind running step lists. Aspirin contraindications? No. Pre-existing ulcer? Negative. He reached for Polly's hand without looking and felt the two chewable tabs dock into his palm before he'd fully extended it. She knew his rhythms as well as any surgical nurse. He crushed the pills, sprinkled them under George's tongue. Far down the loop road, the ambulance siren kindled. First a moth-wing wail, then louder, then unignorable. Relief threatened to sag John's shoulders, but he forced his focus narrower. Capillary refill? Delayed. Peripheral cyanosis? Marginal. "You're doing fine, George," he said, though his organs felt packed in ice. The ambulance arrived within 7 minutes. Impressive, given the tourist traffic along Route 2. Two EMTs vaulted out, crisp in navy slacks and adrenaline smiles. John rattled off vitals, drug admin times, pain scale. The certainty in his voice surprised even him. Procedure sometimes felt like a language he'd learned in infancy, accessible even under emotional siege. They slid George onto the gurney, buckled straps, rolled him toward the rear doors. "Doc?" George croaked. John leaned close. The clerk's fingers squeezed. "Finish the game for me." A wan grin. John's answering smile trembled but held. "Win by a mile," he promised. Doors slammed, siren wound up, gravel kicked, and just like that, the meadow reclaimed its uneasy quiet. Someone, Pete, maybe, corked the lemonade jar. Mrs. Pendergast dabbed her eyes with a gingham napkin she would later proclaim ruined by mascara. Children, mercifully sequestered downstream chasing minnows, stayed oblivious. From the forest edge, Henry appeared, hands on knees, catching breath, relief smoking from him like sweat from a furnace plate. In the sudden aftermath, John's body, obedient through crisis, rebelled. His right hand began to shake, a fine, infuriating tremor that crawled from fingertip to wrist. He jammed it into the pocket of his chinos, gripping fabric to hide the betrayal, but Polly saw. She stepped close, voice pitched for him alone. "You kept him breathing, John." He swallowed. "And if he doesn't pull through?" The question tasted metallic. "Then you gave him the widest margin possible," she said. "That's what medicine is, a series of margins we fight to widen." The tremor loosened, but did not cease. Henry approached, clapped a heavy, grateful palm on John's shoulder, then, sensing the doctor's fraying control, squeezed once and retreated to help Ruth repack sandwiches. Afternoon tilted toward evening. Shadows lengthened, smudging the croquet wickets until they resembled bent question marks. A pink-gold wash slid over the pond, turning Danvers's reclaimed straw hat into a floating halo beside the dock. Polly drifted among the quilts collecting stray cups, her footsteps deliberate, the day's adrenaline draining from her hips. She kept stealing glances at John, cataloging him now, the same way he'd tallied everyone else earlier, checking for silent bleed-through. When she finally settled on a stump beside him, dusk had seeped far enough that someone, Ruth, probably struck a kerosene lantern. Warm light puddled between them, illuminating mosquitoes that orbited like tiny sacrificial satellites. John flipped a flat, palm-sized stone with his thumb, slate gray, edges worn smooth by generations of shoreline abrasion. He hadn't noticed picking it up. It simply appeared in his fist during the manic stillness after the ambulance left. He weighed it, then skimmed it across the water. The stone skittered, 1, 2, 3 skips, before the pond swallowed it. Ripples widened, concentric, until darkness blurred them out. "Each life saved," he murmured, "only reminds me how fragile every other one is." Polly considered that. The lantern caught hints of auburn in her lashes. "And each sunrise reminds us the night eventually yields," she said, tone softer than scripture, firmer than hope. "You never blame dawn for ending dusk." He exhaled, something between a laugh and sigh. "Borrow that for a sermon? Only with proper citation." she bumped his knee with hers, gentle as wind nudging chimes. Behind them, Ruth extinguished one lantern, then another, leaving only the stump light. Cool air pressed inland off the pond, filling the hush with the scent of aquatic peat and wood smoke from distant campsites. Fireflies emerged, stitching neon semicolons in the gossamer gloom. Under that fading hush, John stooped, retrieved another stone, this one smaller, river pea smooth, and curled his palm around it. He pressed thumb to its flat face, feeling the residual solar warmth seep away, replaced by his own pulse. Polly rose, dusted grass from her skirt. "We should head in before the mosquitoes carry Mrs. Pendergast off." John nodded, pocketed the stone, and turned. Lanterns winked out one by one until only the moon's understated ghostlight guided them toward the wagons. The meadow no longer smelled of sandwiches, but of cooling earth, the subtle perfume of a day that had spent all its bright currency and now slid contentedly into ledgered memory. He walked behind Polly, Henry, and Ruth, listening to their silhouettes converse in low tones about leftover coleslaw, about returning Danvers's waterlogged hat, about nothing urgent. And as the cicadas throttled down their evening chorus, John noticed the tremor in his hand had eased to a mild echo, as if the body, too, acknowledged that for tonight, just tonight, the margins they'd fought to widen were holding. But seasons, like accounts, refused to stay balanced for long. Snow had settled into Concord like a long-term tenant, crusting every gable and turning Elm Street into a white-walled corridor that narrowed the world to what lay directly in front of your boots. 2 full years had slipped by since the picnic, the kind of years that seemed unremarkable until you read old ledger margins and realized Polly had switched typewriter ribbons 7 times and John had worn through the elbows of 3 wool jackets. Now, on a January morning in 1966, the clinic's frosted windows glowed pewter and the radiators clanged with the dogged cheer of coal ghosts refusing to quiet down. John Hollis III stood in the doorway between reception and his office, his thumb rubbing circles over the flat of his tie clip as he tried to decide which avalanche to tackle first, the one roaring inside his chest whenever he remembered the mortgage balloon payment due in March, or the literal avalanche of forms that teetered on Polly's desk. Triplicate insurance packets, in pink, yellow, and white, spilled out of a toppled in-tray. The carbon copies curled like wilted petals. A draft rattled the window pane. One renegade pastel sheet fluttered upward, performed a melancholy pirouette, and landed across the toe of his boot. "I leave you alone with bureaucracy for 5 minutes," he said, returning the orphan to its flock, "and already Concord earns a snowfall advisory for paperwork accumulation." Polly crouched on the floor, her skirt hem brushing the radiator grill. Her cheeks were florid from the heat and the indignity of defeat by office supplies. "Do not blame me, doctor. The typewriter ate line 3 of every authorization code, so I tried to hand-ink the missing digits, and the carbon monsters staged a revolt. I swear they reproduced mid-drawer, like sea monkeys, only grumpier." She shook an ink-sticky hand, flinging micro-splats onto the linoleum. Her braid, freed from the pencil that normally anchored it, hung loose over one shoulder. When she huffed at the stray hairs tickling her lips, she left a charcoal smudge on her cheekbone. John had the mad urge to wipe it away with his thumb, an impulse he buried under professional courtesy and the yawning weight of accounts receivable. "Let me fetch towels," he said, backing toward the kitchenette. "No time," she answered. "The hospital board meeting's in 40 minutes. Your necktie's still in your coat pocket and the Ford windshield is an ice rink. Get coffee. I'll tame this." She brandished a wooden ruler as though it were a cavalry saber, then muttered, "Galloping combustion," Henry would say, before sweeping papers into orderly stacks. Across the foyer, the electric wall clock, a sleek chrome plate Ruth had bought the previous Christmas, tick-ticked too loudly, its minute hand jerking in nervous half-steps. The sound was like someone impatiently drumming a countertop, and John wondered if clocks could mock a man. He relented to Polly's marching orders, retreated to the kitchenette, and stood before the percolator's bleary glass knob, waiting for the water to bubble. He rubbed the ridge on his ring finger knuckle, the ghost of a band never worn, and tried to summon enough calm to face Concord Memorial Hospital's board. Behind him, the front door jingled. Boots stomped snow from soles, the heavy, deliberate rhythm of Henry Cartwell. "Morning to the hallowed halls," he boomed, his voice dusted with the shipyard timber that had never entirely weakened. "Weather slinging dollops of snow like a deranged pastry chef. Roads are slicker than mackerel skins." His presence filled the reception area like a pot-bellied stove come to life. Polly looked up from her paper triage, relief flickering. "Henry, bless your sea salt soul. Could you thaw the Ford? Doctors do at Kaplan's round table, and we need every horseshoe of good luck." Henry tipped an invisible cap. "Aye, but the wipers are whining again. They squeal like gulls on a midden heap. Doc, you really must trade that rust box before it leaves you on the lee shore." He punctuated the advice with a wink that said he knew John would ignore it. John poured three mugs, one chipped teal enamel, one with a fading Coca-Cola logo, and a new one printed with "Ask me about my deductible" that Polly swore she'd won in a raffle. No one believed her. He gave the seafaring man the Coke cup, then crossed to reception. Before the steam had faded from the mugs, Ruth Cartwell breezed in, her cheeks ruddy, her woolen shawl peppered with diamonds of melting ice. She shook herself like a sparrow and set a loaf pan on the counter. "Date nut bread," she said, her voice melodic as ever. "For morale." John's smile came easily. "Your kitchen's a better apothecary than my dispensary." Ruth chuckled, but the sound ended in a shallow cough, rapid, two strokes, as though clearing a misfired laugh. Nothing dramatic, still, John's ears pricked. Henry, halfway to the door, paused. His shoulders twitched, an almost imperceptible hitch in the sail rigging, but he said nothing. Ruth waved off the moment, unwrapping the loaf to release a scent of brown sugar and citrus peel that temporarily masked the medicinal tang of antiseptic. "I'll slice it," Polly said, bustling over with a paring knife. "Henry, if you're on windshield duty, take a slab for the road." Henry obliged, though his eyes lingered on Ruth for one breath too long. When he finally stepped outside, a swirl of snow chased in after him like loyal terriers before Polly slammed the door. "Tick, tick," said the chrome clock. "Board meeting," Polly reminded. She produced a rectangle of blotting paper and began dabbing the ink freckling John's cuffs. "Best not look like you lost a napalm drill with the fountain pen." John grunted assent, donned his camel hair overcoat, slipped the bright red scarf Ruth had knitted around his neck, and braced himself for the hospital's polished floors and paler politics. Concord Memorial Hospital sat atop a hill, its red brick facade proud as a courthouse. The parking lot had been plowed into uneven berms. Wind rattled along the drifts like a broom through rust-brown corn stalks. John parked beside a gleaming Buick Roadmaster that undoubtedly belonged to someone whose shoes never touched slush. As he climbed the granite steps, he ran fingers through windswept hair, hoping a part in the liberal arts sense was still discernible. Inside, institutional lighting drained color from everything. Walls, people, even conversation. On the boardroom level, a secretary with lacquered curls ushered him to a chair two seats from the end. Oak paneling, green banker's lamps, crystal water pitcher. The standard trappings designed to make decisions appear judicious instead of merely expensive. Hospital board chair Dr. Francis Kaplan, stooped yet stern, spectacles perched on the tip of a beakish nose, rapped the gavel once. "Minutes from last session have circulated. We proceed to new business, budget overruns and charitable care." John's spine stiffened. He reached for the water glass but left it untouched. His fingers would betray the faint tremor that still visited on high-stakes days. Kaplan continued, "Clinical outliers account for 14% of pro bono services this quarter. One practice alone constitutes nearly half that figure. He adjusted his frames and looked directly at John. A slow hush fell across the mahogany table. Even the fluorescent ballast seemed to hold its breath. Across the table, Mr. Carlton Danvers appeared, arms folded, lips curled into a punctuation mark that could have been sympathy or satisfaction. Bay Eastern's emissary had wangled a board advisory post last autumn, ostensibly to represent corporate efficiency. Today he wore a charcoal suit that looked expensive enough to deflect both criticism and weather. Kaplan slid a folder across the polished surface. Dr. Hollis, does Elm Street Clinic intend to remain an independently managed free dispensary? If so, we must reclassify your privileges. Hospital resources are not infinite. John cleared his throat. The room felt suddenly airless, though the vent hummed steadily overhead. My clinic bills when patients can pay, Dr. Kaplan. When they cannot, I bill Medicaid, or I swallow the cost. Rural outreach is in our charter. It was in my grandfather's, too. Healing doesn't pause for solvency. A chair scraped, the squeal abrupt, intimate. A board member with rimless glasses coughed into her fist. Another fiddled with his tie clip. Danvers leaned forward, weaving velvet into his baritone. No one questions your beneficence, doctor, but goodwill must coexist with fiscal stewardship. Bay Eastern has offered repeatedly a tiered plan to integrate your patients without compromising care. As he spoke, he rotated a gold fountain pen between manicured fingers. Subtle semaphore that signatures were the solution to all worries. John's jaw flexed. Your definition of integration relocated Mrs. Pendergast to a clinic 25 miles away because her zip code didn't align with projected reimbursement. That compromise will not pass my threshold for care. Silence stretched until even the vent seemed to hush. Kaplan opened his mouth, thought better of it, and closed the folder instead. We will table this for legal review, he ruled. But be advised, Dr. Hollis, future charity write-offs will require pre-authorization. Pre-authorization. The syllables tasted like tin. John nodded once, a curt gesture meant to convey compliance, but promising none. A reflective beat passed. He pictured Polly elbow deep in triplicate forms, Henry shoveling a path to the clinic at dawn, Ruth's cough. Then the meeting droned on. Flu vaccine allocations, staff holiday schedules. But John's mind roamed the route between Elm Street and the Cartwell Farm, picturing Ruth's cough replayed in a winter barn that gaped like an empty ribcage. Back at the clinic, dusk gathered early, violet light pressed against window panes already chalked with condensation halos. John trudged through the door, his coat shoulders powdered white. Polly was perched on the reception stool with her shoes kicked off, massaging one instep while squinting at a claim form. How many signatures did Kaplan demand? She asked without looking up. More than there are feet in a centipede colony, he said, dropping his briefcase with a weighty thud. Any evening walk-ins? Just Timothy Sullivan's mother for cough syrup. Polly slid from the stool and padded to the kitchenette, her wool socks slipping on the tile. I've reheated coffee. It's strong enough to polish silver, but it's hot. He followed. The radiators hissed behind them, exhaling metallic sighs. Steam from the mug fogged John's glasses. He took a swallow, grimaced. You weren't exaggerating. Desperate times. She blew into her own cup, then studied him over the rim. How bad? He forced a wry smile. Bad enough, I considered selling the Ford in exchange for ink cartridges. They stood there, shoulder to shoulder, the variety of quiet unique to colleagues who have run out of bravado but not resolve. Tick, tick. The electric clock in the hallway sounded louder without conversation cloaking it. John wanted to smash the thing. Instead, he rinsed his cup and tried to focus on mundane logistics. Through the half-open door came a soft rustle, followed by Henry's unmistakable low whistle. John stepped out. The farmer had laid his snow-dusted coat over a waiting room chair. He clutched a paper bag from Crawford Grocers and wore an expression like gravel, rough, dependable. Ruth made lamb stew, he said, hefting the bag. Thought you and Polly might need victuals. Smells better than the glue you're drinking. Polly emerged and saluted. Henry Cartwell, purveyor of miracles. He waved dismissively, but his eyes darted toward the hallway, where Ruth's cough sounded again, this time deeper, as though dredged from river silt. Ruth herself appeared around the corner, wiping flour from her palms. I was packaging the biscuits, she explained. Didn't mean to interrupt. John noted her pallor now that the overhead light struck full on, a faint grayish cast along the temples, the way shadows pooled under her cheekbones more than usual. She smiled, bright enough you might overlook it. Henry set the grocery bag on the desk, then fiddled with the chain to his pocket watch. Ruth, where's your scarf? Draft's nasty. I forgot, she said lightly, then turned to Polly. Saw your porch light flicker on my walk over. Bulbs loose again. Henry's brow pinched, an expression he normally reserved for busted tractor belts. A body coughing in this weather shouldn't stroll evening streets. Oh, hush, exercise keeps me younger than you, Ruth teased, but the joke skimmed weakly. John pressed the back of his hand to Ruth's forehead under the pretext of brushing away a breadcrumb. Warm, not feverish, yet warmer than he'd like. She coughed again, pressing two knuckles to her sternum, a habit people adopt when echo inside the chest cavity feels foreign. Why don't we schedule you for a full physical? He asked softly. She demurred. Soon as the Valentine bake sale's behind me. John didn't push, but the dread set anchor. Polly busied herself refilling the typewriter ribbon, the mundane ceremony for days too heavy. She pulled the spools, threaded new ink tape, fingers stained black. When she closed the platen and advanced the carriage, the machine jammed. A high-pitched metallic shriek, followed by the harrowing flutter of paper bowing under tangled type bars. Oh, for the love of Josephine March, Polly snapped, yanking the lever. Carbon copies sprang out like startled crows, confettiing the air. When the last scrap of confetti paused mid-air, one lodged in Ruth's bun. Another fluttered to Henry's coat sleeve. For a second, even John laughed, a short, necessary release. Then the moment broke. Ruth coughed harder, a ragged bark ending in silence so abrupt it felt like a dropped phone line. Instinctively, Henry reached for her elbow. You all right, lass? The words, normally hearty, arrived hushed. I'm fine, she insisted, though her voice cracked like thin ice. John walked to the drug cabinet, extracted a stethoscope, and returned. Humor me. She acquiesced, unbuttoning the collar of her cardigan. He placed the diaphragm to her back. Breath sounds wheezed faintly at the bases. Bronchial, not yet alarming, but edging there. He masked his concern under professional neutrality. Likely a winter bug. He offered a mild expectorant from the shelf. Plenty of fluids, rest, and we'll formalize that physical next week. She patted his hand. Doctor's orders it is. Henry looked unconvinced. Still, he tugged on his coat and gathered the grocery bag. They bundled out into the snow, Henry's broad figure sheltering Ruth from wind as they walked home. John watched them trudge down Elm Street until the swirl of flakes erased the silhouettes. A reflective beat lingered in the doorway, John's breath ghosting the glass, mind racing faster than the wind. Late that night, John sat alone at the reception desk, knees cramped, lamp throwing an amber puddle across the appointment ledger. Polly had gone upstairs hours earlier, leaving a note. Went to bed. Don't stay up till the clock scolds you. The radiator clanged in a rhythmic bursts like distant artillery. Outside, the nor'easter shivered window glass. Snow caked the panes until only a faint twilight smudge marked each street lamp. He opened a fresh sheet of onion skin and addressed it to his grandfather instead of his father, unsure why the generation skip felt correct. The pen hovered, quivering slightly. When does mercy become indulgence? He wrote. When do good intentions ossify into negligence? The nib scratched the question, ink pooling darkly, He sat there listening to the overactive clock until the seconds became an irritant, then a dare. In the hollow hush came footsteps, light, deliberate. Ruth's? No. Polly appeared, robe-belted, slippered feet whispering. She set a steaming teapot beside him. Chamomile, she said, to bribe you into quitting before dawn. He closed the journal page, blotting it shut. You're supposed to be sleeping. Couldn't. She poured two cups, sat across from him. Kaplan rattled you worse than you show. Kaplan I can handle, he sighed. It's time and symptoms I can't bully. She waited. Silence allowed the radiator hiss to claim the room. When she finally spoke, her voice held a resolute gentleness. I heard Ruth in the hallway earlier. The cough's not friendly. I know. We'll get answers. We always try, he said, staring into the teacup as if divination might surface. They drank in quiet until the clock struck one, only it didn't chime. It merely ticked on, louder, insistent. John imagined the gears spinning like tiny metronomes, counting each breath left in the building. Eventually, Polly rose. Leave the ledgers. Come upstairs. Paperwork can wait. People can't. She left before he could frame an objection. John cleaned the pen, wrote a single-line addendum to the aborted letter. We widen margins or we fail, and then obeyed, switching off the lamp. The hallway darkened, but the chrome clock still glinted, merciless, reflecting each passing second. March bled into April, then reversed toward February again, when a furious second nor'easter barged through New England. Snow banked against the clinic's clapboard like siege dunes. In early evening, Ruth phoned to cancel her checkup, her voice hoarse. Chairman of the bake sale caught flu. I'm stepping in. Priorities, doctor? She teased. John insisted on driving out instead. Polly slapped a thermos of lemon tea into his hand and loaded the Ford with sample inhalers. Hedging patrol, she called it. He reached Ruth's porch to find her pale but smiling, icing sugar cookies shaped like violins for a church fundraiser. She yielded to a full exam under protest, joking that the stethoscope was colder than the wind. Findings: mild fever, lymph nodes spongy, breath sounds coarse. He ordered labs, scheduled imaging downtown. Ruth accepted, though her eyes betrayed disquiet. That night, Henry lingered after chores. He stood in the clinic doorway while Polly locked cabinets. Doc, he said, his voice gentler than usual, I've seen oak keels rot from the inside. Looks sturdy until a boot heel goes clean through. Don't let pride be that rot in Ruth. Then he left, boots crunching, leaving a trail of sawdust-scented cold behind. A short reflective beat, John pressed his palm to the doorframe, feeling the grain, wondering if any structure, wood or human, was ever truly solid. The lab requisition queue at Concord Memorial had tripled thanks to a statewide insurance audit, and results crawled. John pressed for them daily. Polly bribed lab tech Millie with Mrs. Pendergast's infamous rum cake, but even sugar-steeped bribery could not accelerate bureaucracy. Meanwhile, Ruth's cough faded then flared. Fatigue shadowed her bright humor. Paperwork multiplied. New Medicare forms arrived thick as phone books, each demanding codes that seemed written in hieroglyphs. One bleak Tuesday, Polly's typewriter misaligned again, spewing half-printed lines that looked like Morse code from a sinking vessel. She yanked the carriage, and the ribbon exploded backward, slapping her cheek with ink. She laughed, strange and brittle, then slammed the machine shut so hard a keycap popped off and ricocheted into the candy dish. John crossed the room, placed a steady hand on her shoulder until her breathing evened. A beat of shared exhaustion passed between them. That evening, he found her kneeling in the storage closet, organizing band-aids by length, a task she'd already finished the week before. Without looking up, she whispered, "If we lose her, Henry will founder." John said nothing. There were no antiseptics for that fear. May 9th, 1967, 5:48 p.m. A snowfall of dusk, though the calendar promised spring. Ruth kept her rescheduled appointment. She arrived alone, cloaked in a navy overcoat that seemed to swallow her small frame. Polly noted she had fastened the middle button, but left the top two undone, as though breath itself was too dear to squander on a full closure. In her gloved hand, she carried an index card. Snow caked the windows. Radiator pipes pinged. John emerged from his office, wiping iodine from his palms. Ruth smiled, a soft flex of lip muscles, but her eyes brimmed unshed tiredness. "I believe this is yours," she said, sliding the card across Polly's desk. Polly turned it over. Tuesday, June 6, 9 a.m., penciled in Ruth's neat librarian script. Her next physical, 3 weeks out. "Noted," Polly murmured, her throat tight. John couldn't help noticing how the muffled world outside looked suspended, snowflakes drifting, street lamps glowing, all sound padded. Inside, only the rasp of card against wood and the remote tick of the chrome clock registered. He started to speak, but words felt cumbersome. Instead, he watched Ruth tuck a loose strand of silver hair behind her ear, straighten her shoulders, and offer a smile sturdy enough to hold them all upright for one more moment. In the hush that followed, the card rested like a simple promise between them, an appointment, a future date, fragile but written down all the same. While beyond the windows, the snowfall muted every other certainty Concord thought it knew. Seasons shifted quietly. November settled over Concord in a hush, so complete it seemed to muffle memory itself. Leaves had already performed their brief cathedral blaze and surrendered. Now only bare elm limbs scraped the pewter sky outside the Elm Street Clinic. A faint rim of rime clung to window corners where the radiator's heat could not quite reach, casting a delicate frost filigree. Inside, antiseptic mingled with the faint aroma of Ruth Cartwell's nutmeg-sprinkled pumpkin loaf, cooling beside the ledger, its scent mingling with the soft hum of the clinic's morning stir. It was Tuesday, the 19th of the month, dawn still an hour away, and John Hollis III stood waiting for the building to finish waking before he admitted that he too was afraid of what the morning might bring. His dark hair was tousled, and the ink smudges on his cuffs seemed more pronounced in the dim light. For nearly 18 months, Ruth's penciled promise, June 6th, 9 o'clock, had come and gone in the book of appointments, replaced by follow-ups that migrated farther down the calendar each time a church committee needed her or Henry's rheumatic wrist required rest from orchard pruning. She had arrived at every eventual visit in an apron dusted with flour or sawdust as proof life was more urgent than tests. Each time John coaxed her to sit still long enough for a stethoscope, she obliged, cheerful and sturdy, but the cough never fully retreated. By late summer of 68, it had learned new registers, sometimes hollow as a porch rail, sometimes tight as a knot pulled wrong. John scheduled a pelvic exam after she reported a pressure low in her belly, like an overeager kneader at the bakery. She laughed when she said it. He did not. Now, on this brittle November morning, blood work and smear slides sat in a chilled courier pouch, waiting to trade the clinic's dim lamplight for the fluorescence of Concord Memorial's lab. Polly Finch, her strawberry blonde braid secured with two pencils today, slipped through the reception door balancing a tin pail that steamed around its lid. "Weaponized chowder," she announced, cheeks pink from brisk air, her mismatched socks peeking out from under her hem. To thank Millie in advance for processing Ruth's panels before the administrative sphinx wakes. The sound of her boots on the floor and the scent of the chowder filled the space, momentarily dispelling the tension. John managed half a smile. Bribery, or culinary diplomacy. A difference without distinction. She nudged the thermos of coffee toward him, then peeled her gloves and reached for the courier pouch. The raw circles under her eyes confirmed she too had not trusted sleep. Her eyes, red-rimmed from lack of rest, locked onto John's for a moment, conveying a deep concern. The front door opened again. Ruth and Henry entered like contrasting punctuation marks. She, a parenthesis of gentle motion, he, a hulking bracket. Ruth had wrapped herself in a caramel-colored shawl that made her silver bun look freshly minted. Henry carried a knit cap kneaded nearly shapeless between his fists, That wool suffered the same tight-jawed treatment his tools endured when storms threatened the orchard. The sound of the door closing behind them was soft, a gentle click that seemed to seal the morning's purpose. "Morning, my dears," Ruth said, steady as candlelight. Her breath showed only faintly in the foyer, but John observed the slight hitch after she spoke. In one mittened hand, she held a paper sack of blueberry scones for Polly. The other smoothed Henry's coat sleeve, as if his worry were lint she might brush off. The gesture was tender, a small moment of intimacy that spoke volumes about their relationship. They drove the mile to Concord Memorial in silence, heat sputtering through vents, windows fogging at the corners. The station wagon's wipers uttered their age-old complaint on each arc, sounding for all the world like cranky violin strings begging rosin. Polly clutched the chowder pail between her knees. The tin radiated clam brine warmth into the chilled cabin. John fixed his gaze on the road but kept Ruth in peripheral watch. She sat upright, mittened hands folded, breathing through her nose in disciplined cadence. Bravery, he thought, often looked like etiquette under siege. The windshield wiper's rhythmic squeak and the soft hum of the heater created a somber melody. At the hospital's back entrance, the loading dock bulb throbbed amber against frost-encrusted dumpsters. A single paper sign, "Outpatient Drop," fluttered, stuttered, then fell quiet again. They climbed the concrete steps, Polly leading, boots clicking rapid Morse. Inside, the lab corridor yawned sterile and too bright. Sodium vapor lights bleached color from skin, from memory, perhaps even from hope. John always felt smaller under that glow. The air was thick with the scent of disinfectant and the faint tang of medical waste. Lab technician Millie Brennan materialized from behind a rack of hematology slides, wearing mint-green scrubs patterned with cartoon beakers. Her round spectacles flashed at every angle. "You're early and you're crazy," she chirped, though she waved them farther in. "The docket's 12 inches thick, thanks to Boston's latest billing audit." Her accent still carried a bit of Dorchester, a warm, raspy tone that put them at ease. As she moved, her eyes sparkled with a hint of mischief, a trait that made her seem more like a friend than a lab technician. Polly hoisted the pail. "Mollusk persuasion." Millie sniffed theatrically, then sighed. "Put it by the microscope. If Becker sees it first, he'll claim it's for morphology research." She pivoted toward a workbench, yanking at the latex covering her right shoe. The bow of her shoelace gave, whipped, and the lace slapped her ankle with a wet smack. "Oh, for the love of Faraday," she cursed, pitching half a staccato dance until the knot surrendered. The performance broke the tension. Even Henry released the hint of a chuckle that rumbled low, like distant surf. Timer bells dinged in the next bay, high, insistent, fleeting. Millie reset switches with the reflex of a pianist striking grace notes, then accepted the courier pouch from John. "Stat, I assume?" He nodded. "And discreet." She raised two fingers in scout salute. "Won't speak a syllable till I have numbers worth speaking about." "Go hydrate. I'll hunt you down when it's time to fidget." The words were reassuring, a promise that she would handle the task with care and urgency. They took refuge in the volunteer lounge, a windowless box dressed in linoleum, the color of institutional mustard. A vending machine muttered under buzzing ballast. The only other occupant, a med-surg resident collapsed over a crossword, offered a vague wave. Polly produced styrofoam cups, filled them at the hot water spigot, plopped in sachets of black tea. The steam smelled faintly metallic, as though mined from boiler pipes. The air was stale, recycled, but the tea was a comforting ritual. John's stethoscope rested across his lap. Habit without purpose here. Yet the chilled diaphragm comforted him when he thumbed its edge. Ruth cradled her cup with both hands, sipping quietly, eyes studying the dent in the floor tile as though it contained a map. The hush grew until even Henry's breathing seemed loud. To puncture it, Polly recounted Danvers's latest newsletter, 6 pages on best billing practices, reading aloud the opening line in faux baritone. "Healthcare is not charity, it is a scalable service model. Henry snorted so sharply his tea threatened a mutiny. Ruth's shoulders shook with silent laughter, and color returned to her cheeks for an instant. The joke survived precisely long enough for Millie to push through the lounge door. She had traded her cartoon beaker coat for a plain white one, and that omission told John more than numbers. Still, she held the printout, gripping its edge as if any sudden motion might slice water. "I'd rather talk someplace you feel steadier," she said softly. They followed her back into the lab, but she steered them into a small consult cubicle with frosted glass walls and two squeaking chairs. Henry remained standing. The ceiling fixture burned over his close-cropped hair like a spotlight on a war monument. Millie laid the sheet on the desk between Ruth and John, spoke with methodical calm. CA-125 is elevated, significantly. Smear cytology shows malignant epithelial cells consistent with ovarian origin. You need definitive imaging, but the markers line up. Her words cascaded in clinical cadence, yet each landed like a pebble on still water, sending ragged ripples. Ruth inhaled once, deep but unlabored, and placed her mittened hands flat on the desk, accepting the verdict as though it were a final bakery invoice. "Stage?" John asked, voice sheared down to basics. "Likely late 2, maybe early 3, but we can't know until exploratory." Treatment options unfurled in John's mind like grim flags. Radical hysterectomy, cisplatin cocktails, survival curves plotted against age 56 and hemoglobin counts. He forced the loop to pause. He needed Ruth unburdened by statistics for the moment. Millie excused herself, leaving silent cubic feet behind. The fluorescent ballast hummed tiny, endless syllables. Ruth broke the hush first. "Well," she said, smoothing the page, "so much for blaming the cough on choir practice." Henry's cap twisted harder between his fists. When John looked at his friend, he saw knuckles white against wool, saw pupils dilated until sea blue nearly vanished. Henry's jaw moved twice before any sound formed, and when it came, it was smaller than usual. "We fight," he whispered. "Of course we fight," Ruth answered, voice gentle but firm. She turned to John. "You'll map the path?" "I will," he promised, though promise felt like a thread in a gale. He folded the results, slid them into the inside pocket of his coat. "Let's head back to the clinic. Lay this out where conversation feels human." The drive home crawled. Snowflakes began their aimless rehearsal over Walden Pond, twirling in headlight cones. Ruth watched them the way parishioners sometimes watch dust motes drift through stained glass sunbeams, hypnotized but oddly peaceful. Polly gripped the door handle to curb the tremor that wanted to travel up her arm. Henry's silence filled the cabin so densely it seemed to compress the very air. John had to remind himself to breathe deeper lest fog reclaim the windshield. The snowflakes danced in the headlights, a mesmerizing ballet that seemed to slow time itself. When they arrived, Polly shepherded everyone through the side entrance to the kitchenette, reasoning that coffee pots and breadboards formed a better fortification than the wide, echoing waiting room. She set Ruth at the small dinette table, whose formica top wore a spiderweb crack. The overhead bulb buzzed, the stove pilot ticked, something smelled faintly of souring milk until John discovered an abandoned beaker of cold creamer and sent it to the sink. Mundane chores allowed one to defer despair by seconds at a time. The kitchen was warm, a haven of domesticity in the midst of uncertainty. Polly ladled chowder into ceramic mugs, sprinkled paprika, passed them around. John watched Ruth cradle hers, inhaling the sea air vapor with eyes closed. He saw a faint tremble in her left hand, only the rim quivered against the mug, but she steadied it by bracing her elbow on the scarred tabletop. No declarations, no lament. Just that single adjustment, silent testament to resolve. The chowder was a comfort, a reminder of the simple pleasures that remained. Henry did not drink. He stared at nothing. Cap on the table, fingers splayed across its crown. John placed a hand over those broad knuckles. Warmth meeting warmth, no words needed. After a moment, Henry exhaled through his nose as though rediscovering the concept. They discussed surgical consults in Boston, chemotherapy regimens, the trials at Mass General. Ruth listened, asked about recovery times, noted prices with a slight grimace. She thanked John for the clarity, thanked Polly for already penciling potential dates. Then she pushed back her chair. "One more thing," she said, reaching into the pocket of her shawl. She withdrew a pink scallop shell, edges dulled by decades of tidal polish, surface marbled with cream striations. Everyone knew it at once, one of the shells she had wired into the driftwood bouquet 4 summers prior. John had noticed a gap recently among the spiral conches, but assumed time or gravity had pilfered it. The shell was a tangible connection to their past, a symbol of resilience. She held the shell up so the light glinted off its nacre. "Sometimes," she said, turning it between finger and thumb, "the day doesn't give you anything smooth. You need to hold something that already survived the rough places and came out grace-shaped." She extended it toward John. "For when you forget, kindness works." The words were a benediction, a reminder of the importance of compassion in the face of adversity. He accepted with careful fingers, felt the cool salt memory in its arch. The shell was small yet unexpectedly heavy, as though it contained compressed hours of seashore wind. He did not trust himself to speak. He nodded instead, blinking once to clear salt from his own manufacture. Polly fetched butcher paper, wrapped Ruth's leftover scones, and slid them into Henry's coat pocket. "Fuel for the watch," she said. Her voice wavered on the word, but held. The gesture was a small act of kindness, a reminder that even in darkness, there was still comfort to be found. Dinner time passed unnoticed. At 9:30, the clinic's clocks displayed wrists sore from ticking. John reheated the chowder, set 4 bowls on the table. They ate slowly, spoons clinking like buoy bells out on a fog-thick harbor. Midway through, Polly's spoon slipped and splattered Henry's sleeve. Her gasp freed a short laugh from Ruth, and the ordinary mishap landed with disproportionate relief. There, amid iodine sting and simmering cream broth, humanity reasserted itself. The shared meal was a moment of normalcy, a brief respite from the weight of their circumstances. By 10, John insisted on driving Ruth and Henry home. Polly stayed behind to lock cabinets and stoke the furnace. She pressed the seashell into John's pocket like a boarding pass, reminding him with a glance, not words, to keep it near. Snow had thickened to a steady veil when the Ford eased onto Elm Street. Street lamps painted cones of amber through which flakes drifted, lazy and inscrutable. At the Cartwell farmhouse, the porch bulb burned weak gold. Wind worried the cedar shingles, drawing a ghostly moan from the eaves. John climbed the steps, one hand on Ruth's elbow. Floorboards flexed underfoot, squealing their age but holding. Henry unlocked the door, swung it wide. Warmth and the faint scent of linseed oil drifted out. Inside, an oak rocker occupied its permanent post beside the window, cushion indented where Ruth often read hymnal proofs on winter evenings. The room was a haven, a warm and welcoming space that seemed to envelop them in comfort. She paused by the rocker, resting fingertips on its high back. The wind pressed against the panes. The chair answered with a faint complaint of wood on wood. She did not sit. Instead, she leaned, absorbing its promise of rest without taking it. John noticed the way her shoulders squared, as though receiving an unseen anointing. Henry set her overnight bag near the hearth, then returned to the door, cheeks damp despite no snow having reached them. He shook John's hand, grip fierce, nails biting skin, but still no words. Ruth turned to John. "Tomorrow you'll tell me which surgeon snaps the cleanest stitches," she said, voice the calm one uses to remind a pupil of homework. He nodded. "And you'll tell me whether clam chowder offends oncology staff," Polly added from the porch behind him. She had driven Henry's truck to meet them, insisting the clinic needed both drivers back quickly. Her sudden appearance startled a laugh out of Ruth. "Bring it," Ruth said. "Equipment or bribes, far as I'm concerned, they're the same lifeline. The words were a testament to her spirit, a determination to face whatever lay ahead with courage and humor. Good nights were exchanged, brief and practical. John and Polly descended the porch steps, snow squeaking under soles. At the elm-edged driveway, John paused, peered back. Through the window, Ruth's silhouette crossed the parlor, bent to feed the stove. Henry moved behind her, setting a palm to her back, a lighthouse keeper's gesture guiding a vessel into harbor. Then curtains closed, and the house became a mute geometry of light and shadow. On the porch, the oak rocker remained empty. Wind threaded through its spindles, nudging it a fraction. It began a slow, creaking nod, forward then back, floorboards answering with weary sighs. John stared until the motion matched the measure of his pulse, until he could almost believe the chair breathed. The sound was a lullaby, a soothing melody that seemed to capture the essence of the moment. Polly touched his sleeve. "She'll sit there again," she whispered, though they both understood how thin that promise stretched. The words were a comfort, a reminder that even in the face of uncertainty, there was still hope. They returned to the truck. Tires crunched over the fresh crust. A mile off, the snow-shrouded street lamps faded into the darkness. Winter kept its promise. Daylight on Christmas Eve was fading fast. The last hour of daylight on Christmas Eve slipped away as though someone were slowly dimming the whole town, one porch bulb at a time. John guided the Ford into its usual slot beside the clinic's side door, engine ticking down while flakes lilted through the headlight beams. He killed the ignition, sat a moment, and watched the snow bury the wiper blades. Two house calls, a pneumonia check at the parsonage, and a pharmacy stop had left his shoulders tight enough to creak. Still, the heaviness carried an undercurrent of expectancy he hadn't felt since childhood. Polly slid out first, boots squealing against the packed crust. Her strawberry blonde braid was wrapped in a pencil, and her eyes sparkled with a hint of mischief as she hefted a battered grocery crate from the back seat. "No shortcutting the steps," she warned without turning. "Break your neck now, and I'll have to bully Danvers into lending pallbearers." Her mismatched socks peeked out from under her hem as she balanced the crate on a hip. John managed a grin, followed her up the shoveled path, and shouldered through the door's weight. The vestibule smelled of wool, pine, and the faint tang of antiseptic that never entirely left the place. He hooked his coat onto the hall tree, brushed snow from his dark hair, and listened. Radiator ping, kettle wheeze. The electric clock's relentless quarter-second hop. Normal sounds, yet the air felt tuned a half-step higher, as if the building itself were leaning forward. Polly set the crate on the receptionist's desk and immediately began inventory. 16 mugs, check. Cocoa tins, check. Candy cane stirrers, 17. I'll sacrifice one to quality control. She snapped a cane, tasted it, and sighed theatrically. Acceptable. Her eyes sparkled with amusement as she worked. John headed to the waiting room. They had pushed chairs into a loose semicircle around the tinseled spruce Polly had scrounged from Crawford's back lot, its top missing but camouflaged with a folded hymn sheet. Strips of foil garland looped the branches. Under the nearest radiator, a rogue length had warmed just enough to give off a faint, ironish odor, like pennies held too long in a closed fist. He inhaled, and the smell mingled with cocoa steam drifting from the kitchenette. The aroma was rich and inviting, filling the room with warmth. He crossed to the window and rubbed a clear patch in the condensation. Elm Street lay hushed beneath a steady white fall. Accumulation already swallowed the curb. Good. The more snow, the fewer spectators. Tonight needed stillness. The snowflakes continued to fall, casting a serene silence over the street. Polly appeared carrying a stack of hymnals. "Choir bus left St. Cecilia's 5 minutes ago," she said. Sister Agnes phoned, tire chains rattling but intact. Her voice was low and smooth, a soothing presence in the quiet room. John nodded. "Henry?" He glanced around the room, his eyes searching for the older man. "Due any minute." She paused, eyes scanning the semicircle. "You're sure he'll come?" Her brow furrowed with concern. "He said he'd try." John pinched the bridge of his nose, feeling the earlier house call grit beneath his thumbnail. "Trying is all anyone's managing lately." His eyes felt tired, and his shoulders ached with the weight of the day. They lapsed into work. John trimmed wicks on the hurricane lamps for backup light. Polly folded the patient's sign-in sheets face down so no small eyes lingered on words like carcinoma. Outside, daylight finished its exit. Snow muffled every tire squeal and slammed door until only the occasional rattle of a distant plow disturbed the hush. The silence was almost palpable, a living presence that wrapped around the clinic. Half an hour later, the front knob rattled. John opened it to a gust heavy with flakes and the figure of Henry Cartwell, capped and dusted white like a statue hauled out of storage. Under one arm, he carried Ruth's quilted lap throw, patches of faded hymn covers, and flower sack squares Ruth had sewn during her first convalescent winter. Henry's barrel chest and wind-etched crow's feet were familiar, but his eyes looked sunken, his baritone voice reduced to a sandpaper hush. "Evening, Doc." He stomped snow from his boots and stepped inside, keeping the quilt folded tight against his ribs. Polly intercepted him with practiced cheer. "Cocoa or coffee?" She guided him to the nearest chair, her hand on his elbow. "Whatever's sweet," he said, voice fraying on the adjective. His eyes looked haunted, and his fingers kneaded the quilt's edging as though testing rigging line. She poured cocoa into the oversized mug labeled "Ask Me About My Deductible," slipped in a marshmallow, and handed it to him. Henry sat, quilt across his lap, his eyes fixed on the floorboards as the sounds of the clinic surrounded him. In the front corridor, the telephone trilled. Polly snatched the receiver. "Elm Street Clinic, Finch." A pause, then. "Understood." She cupped the mouthpiece. "Bus turned onto Elm. Give them 2 minutes." Her voice was calm and efficient. John hurried to the door. Snow came to mid-calf. He waded to the curb by habit, lantern in hand. Headlights speared the intersection, followed by the lumbering white school bus Sister Agnes had borrowed from the parish. Chains clacked a steady tattoo as it hissed to the curb. Pneumatic doors sighed open. Inside, 40-odd children in red choir capes blinked at the cold spill. Sister Agnes descended first, smoothing her veil. Her round, ruddy face pressed a smile that somehow suggested both welcome and discipline. Her wire-rimmed glasses glinted in the light as she greeted John. "Dr. Hollis," she greeted. "We tiptoed past curfew traffic. One patch of black ice attempted mutiny, but St. Christopher prevailed." Her voice was warm and gentle, a soothing presence among the children. "St. Christopher and good chains," John said, ushering her toward the clinic. Children filed out in pairs, each instructed to hold mittens. Breath puffed soft halos around their heads. One boy attempted to catch flakes on his tongue until Sister Agnes's soft, "Hush now, cherub," redirected him. Polly met them at the vestibule, directing capes to the coat tree hooks in precise order. Cocoa fragrance greeted each newcomer. A fifth-grade alto hiss whispered, "It smells like the candy aisle," before remembering Sister's rule on idle comment. Boots piled beneath the radiator, puddles already forming. John tracked logistics. Dozens of wet boots, check. Dripping scarves, check. Quick scan of Henry, still seated, quilt anchor in place, mug untouched. He crossed, crouched beside the older man. "They're loud," Henry murmured, eyes on the floorboards as bells and giggles bounced off plaster. "Good loud." His voice was barely audible, but John caught the words. "You sure you're comfortable?" John asked, his hand on Henry's shoulder. Henry nodded once. "Feels like the tide coming back after a long low water." His eyes looked distant, lost in memory. Polly began distributing mugs, cocoa for children under 12, half coffee, half milk for the braver teens. She counted aloud, sotto voce, 9, 10, 11, ensuring every warm hand found ceramic. When she reached Henry, she exchanged his untouched mug for a fresh one, this time passing it with both her hands wrapped over his. The contact startled a flicker of blue in his gaze. Sister Agnes clapped twice, gentle thunder. The room fell to that poised hush only a practiced choir can summon. She glanced at John for permission. He nodded, and she lifted her tuning fork, tapped it against a hymn book. A pure, unhurried A slid through the air. Children straightened. The smallest soprano rose onto her tiptoes. They began with "Angels We Have Heard on High," voices precise yet soft. John positioned himself near the door, outer coat back on. He watched the corridor for any wandering patient, though none were expected. Snow continued thickening against the frosted panes, inches stacking like minutes. Each carol lasted exactly 3 minutes, 30 seconds of breath rehearsal, and then the next. Between songs, Polly replenished mugs. Cocoa ripples danced each time a boy's elbow bumped the rim of his chair. On the fifth piece, O Come Emmanuel, John noticed Henry's shoulders lift, then sag on each minor key descent. Breath clouded above the mug, but he still had not sipped. When the final chord landed, a tremor broke through the quilt. Slight, rhythmic, timed to his pulse. John glanced at Polly. She, too, had seen it. Sister Agnes stepped forward. "One more," she said to the room. "We have sung for pediatrics, for the ward, for the good sisters on call. This last is for the doctor who keeps Concord breathing every hard season, and for any soul who seeks calm tonight." Her eyes met Henry's. "Especially." She raised the fork. The note rang. Children inhaled as one. Silent Night unfurled in the old German text first, as Sister Agnes preferred. Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht, each syllable a candle in still air. Mid-verse, Henry's breath hitched loud enough for John to hear across the semicircle. The cocoa in his mug trembled, casting tiny rings that lapped porcelain. John felt the urge to move, to brace the cup or the man himself, but something wiser held him still. The carol slipped into English for verse 2. On Shepherd's quake at the sight, Henry's head bowed. A single tear cleared the cliff of his cheek, dropped onto the quilt, and darkened one hymn cover square the color of faded robin's egg. Another tear followed. John watched as the fabric absorbed each without complaint. For one breath, no more, the narration shifted inside Henry. He felt Ruth's weight in the rocker beside firelight, smelled her nutmeg bread warming the night air, heard her voice reading Isaiah cadences over the whistle of the kettle. He sensed the very absence of that presence, an emptiness precise as a glass removed from a table, leaving a perfect ring of condensation. The children's harmony poured into that ring, not filling it, but laying a quiet cloth across its chill. Back to John. The third verse began. Snow outside rose halfway up the window ledge. The metallic tinfoil scent thickened as the radiator baked the lower garland run. John breathed it in and thought of scalpels and solder, things forged to cut or connect. The distinction felt smaller than ever. He folded one hand around the scallop shell in his pocket. The cool edge bit gently, reminding him of vows made in November and vows renewed tonight. The final chord suspended, soprano weightless, tenor steady, alto warm. Sister Agnes let her arms hover, refusing resolution. Silence, but alive, sprang open inside the room. No cough, no chair scrape, only the soft hiss of snow against glass. In that hold, Henry's tear tracked into the quilt's seam. The mug stilled. Polly's hand found the back of his broad fingers, rested there, said nothing. John felt the clinic breathe, a collective exhale that loosened something knotted since the diagnosis day. Sister Agnes lowered her hands. The note settled like down. Children relaxed shoulders, exchanged shy glances, unsure whether the applause belonged to sacred space. John cleared his throat, found words thin, then simply nodded thanks. It was enough. Cleanup happened in murmurs. Mugs gathered, capes shrugged on, boots tugged. Polly supplied paper towels for puddles, dabbed each slick print until floorboards reappeared. Sister Agnes aligned children in twos, reminded them to thank the doctor, the nurse, the farmer. Each child obeyed, some softer than others, but sincerity threaded the line. Outside, the bus exhaled diesel and resolved its chains for the return crawl. John and Polly waved until taillights blurred into white squall. Inside, chairs remained askew, tree lights blinking wholly unaware of solemnity. Henry still sat. John crouched, took the cooling mug, set it on the floor. "Need a ride home?" he offered. Henry looked up, eyes reddened, but steady. "Not yet." His voice was firm, but his eyes betrayed a deep sadness. Polly drew another chair beside him, sat without ceremony. John joined, three of them now anchored by the empty rocker's echo halfway across town. Snow hissed at the windows, climbed another inch. The quilt spread across their laps, a symbol of warmth and comfort. They stayed like that, talking little. Polly recounted Danvers's latest newsletter, 6 pages on best billing practices, reading aloud the opening line in faux baritone, "Healthcare is not charity. It is a scalable service model." Henry snorted so sharply his teeth threatened a mutiny. He unfolded the quilt, spread it across all three laps. Without discussion, they accepted its warmth. "Minutes, or maybe miles of snowfall later," Henry spoke. "She'd have liked that lull at the end," he said. "Room felt worthy." His voice was filled with a deep sense of loss. John nodded. "It did." The clock in reception clicked to 9:51, but no one mentioned it. Worth didn't care for timesheets. At last, Henry rose. The quilt slid off their knees like slackened sailcloth. "I can walk," he said. "Snow's kind company." Neither argued. John fetched his coat, escorted him to the door. Outside, flakes feathered his beard, turned him half-mythic in the yellow porch light. "If low water comes again," Henry said, eyes on the blank street, "keep singing." His voice was barely audible, but the words carried a deep sense of longing. "We will," John promised. He watched as Henry descended the steps, boots punching clean ovals that filled even as they formed. He disappeared into whiteness within 40 paces, a slow fade, not erasure, just distance. John lingered under the eave until snow numbed his ears. Then he stepped back inside, hung the coat, and relatched the lock. Polly had switched off all but the tree's colored bulbs. Tiny dots pulsed red, green, blue across the waiting room like heartbeat tracers. She handed him a fresh cocoa, no words. They carried mugs to the window and watched flakes deepen the ledge. At some indistinct point, the tree lights timed out. Only street lamp glow remained, diffused by thick glass and thicker weather. Far away, perhaps only imagined, a church bell issued a single note, low, persuasive. It rang once, then surrendered to the muffled hush. Inside the Elm Street Clinic, December 24, 1968, froze into a quietly breathing tableau. 2 worn mugs, a cooling radiator perfuming warm tin, and the echo of children's harmony settling into floorboards like first seeds under snow. Outside, the building's dark clapboards wore a fresh white mantle. Snow kept falling, indifferent yet gentle, erasing tire ruts, softening footprints, promising by its very patience that morning would find Concord remade. Hours later, John and Polly stayed downstairs until the tree blinked its last colored pulse, and the radiator exhaled a final hiss. The air was heavy with the scent of pine and the faint tang of antiseptic, a familiar blend that clung to the clinic's fabric. Only then did they bank the stove, empty the cocoa dregs, and climb the narrow staircase that creaked beneath their feet, the sound amplified in the new stillness, Concord breathing under fresh snow. John paused outside his room, listening as Polly's voice floated through the thin wall. Just one line, soft, meant for no one but exhaustion itself. "Mercy me, when will my hands quit shaking?" The words were a gentle admission, a quiet acknowledgement of the weight they both carried. He might have answered, might have confessed his own tremor, but something about the hour argued for silence. Instead, he pressed the scallop shell to his sternum until its cold edge stole heat from the bone, then slipped it beneath his pillow. The shell's familiar shape was a comfort, a reminder of the rituals that had sustained them. Sleep came in thin seams, the darkness punctuated by the soft hum of the clinic's radiators. December 24, 1969. The second watch night grew from rumor more than planning. At twilight, a soft knock found Polly in reception, where she sat with a strawberry blonde braid wrapped in a pencil, her eyes tired but alert. On the other side stood Mrs. Pendergast, her crooked felt hat now stitched with a sprig of plastic holly, and Sergeant Earl Whitaker, recently back from Da Nang, his dress blues straining across shoulders gone wiry. He cradled a purple heart the way a priest cradles a chalice, his thumb gliding over the dent left by shrapnel. The sound of their arrival was a gentle reminder that the clinic's doors were open to all who needed solace. Polly's eyes met John's, and together they welcomed the newcomers. Word had reached them that the clinic kept its lights warm on Christmas Eve. So Whitaker polished his metal and came to sit where guitars once echoed in army tents. Mrs. Pendergast arrived to bake grief into meringue. Polly brewed cider. John pushed reception chairs into a circle, and together they waited for whatever hymn the moment required. The room was filled with the scent of cinnamon and the soft murmur of conversation. Snow fell gently outside, a soothing background hum that seemed to wash away the world's worries. Christmas Eve, 1970. Elm Street acquired an electric sign that spring, green neon cursive, Elm Street Clinic, family care since 1911. The sign cast a soft mint green glow over the fresh snow, bathing the clinic in a warm, welcoming light. Attendance doubled, though no invitation was issued. A widow from the River Flats brought knitted caps, just in case. A 10-year-old, Timothy Sullivan, hauled in a dime store transistor radio and spun the dial until he located a station playing big band carols. When the bulbs inside the radio warmed, static became brass trumpets, and Pete the farmhand tapped his healed wrist on his knee in time. Henry arrived late, having shoveled three neighbors' walks first. Frost rimed his beard, and his eyes shone with a deep sadness. In one arm he carried the driftwood bouquet, now minus two more shells, and set it beneath the tree the way others set gifts. He drank coffee doctored with molasses and hummed bass beneath, "Have yourself a merry little Christmas," eyes closed, mouth-shaping vowels Ruth once sang. When the final verse settled, he removed his grandfather's pocket watch, wound it, and murmured, "Margins holding, Doc." The gesture was a testament to his enduring love for Ruth, a quiet acknowledgement of the pain he still carried. John squeezed the old man's shoulder, feeling a deep sense of connection to this man who had become like a father to him. Late spring, 1971. The orchard bloomed the week Henry slipped. No drama. One missed ladder rung, a rib cracked, a fever that ignored antibiotics. John drove out morning and evening, stethoscope chilled by dawn, warmed by dusk, catching breath sounds that ought to clear but didn't. Henry's humor stayed. He complained the nurses at Concord General cut his pie slices too thin, yet John saw the spool winding down. On a humid June morning, Henry asked for the seashell bouquet. John retrieved it from the clinic window and set it on the bedside table. The pink scallop, Ruth's gift, was front center. Henry palmed it, studying ridges smoothed by decades of tide. His eyes were sunken, his voice barely audible, but his words were a testament to the love he still carried for Ruth. "Tell Polly," he said, "that every ledger line she wrote held the roof up," John promised. Henry closed his eyes, a faint smile on his lips. A minute later he asked, "Think the Lord sings bass?" "Likely," John answered, his voice soft with compassion. "Good, Ruth's alto needs a tether." Henry chuckled once, then breathed once more and was gone, still holding the scallop. July 1971. The will surprised nobody, a handwritten page tucked inside Henry's pocket watch tin. He left John the small shingled cottage on Plum Island Sound where he and Ruth had honeymooned. Polly received the pocket watch itself because, the note said, she kept better time than any clock. The seashell bouquet went to the clinic window again, minus the scallop which John carried in his coat. They buried Henry beside Ruth under maples that blushed early that year. After taps faded, Polly set the watch into John's palm. "I'll wind it," she said, "but it's still yours to hear." John closed his fingers over the cool silver case, felt the dent where Henry's thumb had worried the lid. Autumn 1971, winter 1972. Polly typed modest notices. Clinic porch light will burn for anyone needing cocoa or company, deck 24th, dusk till dawn, and tacked them to the library corkboard and the post office window. She bought a ledger, bound in red buckram, placed it on a podium by the waiting room door, and taped a fountain pen to a length of twine so no one could walk off with the ink or the memories. First entry she wrote herself, 24th December 1971, in memory of Ruth and Henry Cartwell, who taught Concord to breathe in unison. That year, a young mother named Cynthia Pierce arrived with a newborn swaddled in thrift store mittens. No father, no heat in her walk-up. She signed the ledger with shaky script, fed the baby warm formula Polly produced from nowhere, and dozed in an exam room cot while John phoned the town deacon about emergency oil vouchers. At dawn, the mother left, mittens replaced by a quilt scrap from Ruth's stash. Warmth found, thank you. A Korean War veteran wandered in near 2 a.m., silver star in his fist, eyes lost to winter fog. He asked if he could sit where Christmas music happened. John steered him to Henry's favorite chair. The man polished the metal until the brass glowed like distant fires, then wrote in the ledger, for those still on patrol. Each name, each sorrow, each small rescue settled between ruled lines. July 1972, Plum Island. Summer salt smelled different here. Less pine, more raw Atlantic. The cottage perched above a sand spit, shingles weather gray, porch rail patched with rope. John arrived carrying only a leather valise, the scallop shell wrapped in a handkerchief, and Henry's pocket watch ticking inside his breast pocket. He opened windows, wind barged through, rattling cupboards. In the kitchen drawer, he found a stack of unmailed postcards, Ruth's handwriting naming shells by Latin genus. Evening light burned the clapboard's copper. He brewed coffee on a temperamental propane stove, then sat at a rickety desk facing the dunes, onion skin paper before him. "Dear Father," he wrote, though the salutation widened as he moved. "Dear Grandfather, dear Henry, dear patient whose pulse I nearly missed." Ink unfurled across three pages. He wrote of fear that never quite leaves a stethoscope's tubing, of ledgers that continue to lean, of cocoa acting as sacrament. He confessed that he still woke at night counting the margins between heartbeat and silence. Yet in those margins, he finally felt enough. He ended, "I am learning to accept that steadiness is not the absence of tremor, but the will to keep stitching while it shakes." Wind dried the ink. He folded the letter, sealed it, addressed nothing, placed it under a paperweight shaped like a loon, and let it stay unread. Next morning, he walked the low tide, trousers rolled, waves stroking ankles. He found a smooth oval stone, slate like Walden but lighter, and pocketed it beside the scallop. The cottage deed he left in Polly's mailbox upon returning, scrawled, "Use this place when Concord feels too heavy." December 24th, 1972. Snow held off that year, surrendering sky to brittle starlight. The neon sign flickered but steadied after Polly's swift thump on the timer box. She wore a peacoat two sizes too large, a thrift find, its sleeves cuffed twice. Mismatched socks peeked above her boots, one red, one green, her only concession to the holiday. Inside, the watch night circle had outgrown the waiting room. Fold-out chairs colonized corridors. Mrs. Pendergast manned the cocoa urn with General of the Kitchen Authority. Timothy Sullivan, now lanky and 16, tuned a battered guitar and led carols. The ledger lay open on a music stand, pages already half-filled by 8 o'clock. John floated room to room, checking blood sugars, warming hands, listening. His hair had sprouted silver at the temples, and the Hollis jaw now favored a day's stubble, but his cuffs still carried ink smudges. Around 10, Polly caught him rubbing the bridge of his nose. She produced the pocket watch, pressed it into his palm. "Your shift," she said. He wound it once, felt the mainspring bite. tick-tick joined the clinic's ambient hum, a sound identical to every year prior, yet suffused now with something like peace. Near 11, a hush passed as organic as weather. Sister Agnes's choir, reduced to 6 graduates and 4 new sopranos, formed a crescent by the tree. At John's nod, they began, "Lo, how a rose you're blooming. Candlelight, real wax this year, gilded every face." A young mother at the back smoothed thrift store mittens over her toddler's fists. Whitaker traced his metal's edge. Mrs. Leck Pendergast dabbed eyes behind pie-tinted spectacles. Mid-carol, John felt movement at his side. Polly had opened the ledger to a blank spread. She dipped the fountain pen, handed it over. He hesitated, then wrote, 24th December 1972, for margins widened, for hands steadied, for voices that keep night watch. Below, Polly added her line, and for tomorrow, which always shows up anyway. The song resolved on a chord so soft, even the neon outside seemed to dim in respect. Silence blossomed, large, tender. Somewhere across Concord, church bells acknowledged midnight. A single peal, then another, echo over echo across rooftops. Sound traveled the frozen air, slipped through clinic walls, and vibrated the ledger's blank bottom line like a tuning fork awaiting more names. John closed the book, his eyes meeting Polly's in a moment of deep understanding. "We'll need volume 2 next year," he murmured. Polly smiled, fatigue bright in her eyes, hope brighter. "Already ordered. Blue buckram this time." She cupped a candle, shielding the flame from a draft. Wax pooled at her knuckle. She didn't flinch. John looked around. Veteran, widow, choir child, exhausted mother, and understood the ritual required nothing more elaborate than presence. In that realization, the old fret loosened. He felt the scallop and the Walden stone settle in his pocket. One cool, one warm, a reminder of the memories they had shared and the journey that lay ahead. Outside, the final bell note faded, sliding across snow-patched roofs, through naked elm limbs, over the silent pond, where stones once skipped, until it vanished into winter sky, leaving in its wake a hush vast enough to fit every story yet to be written in the yawning ledger on Elm Street. Thank you for choosing Astory Publishing.